Welcome. My name's Adrian Beebe, and this is the 11th in the series of podcasts about the village of Kington Langley in North Wiltshire. Everybody loves a good story. Emily Tanner certainly did. At the turn of the 20th century, Emily was Kington Langley's postmistress, and also the mother of Robin Tanner, the artist about whom we spoke in episode 8. She ran the post office from her home in the Barton, the cottage just off Upper Common. And like many people back then, over 100 years ago, when the nights drew in and her children were preparing for bed, Emily liked to tell a story, a strange story. Perhaps to scare her children, perhaps to warn them of the consequences of hard liquor and ill discipline. But what's really intriguing about Emily's story is that it's based on real events, events that took place in Kington Langley 40 years before she told her tale. In fact, it turns out that Emily Tanner's bedtime story is a retelling of what is arguably Kington Langley's most famous death, a death that made headlines right across Britain. So in this episode, we're going to tell you Emily's story, perhaps the first time it's been spoken aloud in decades, and we'll also tell you the real story behind it. You're listening to Memories of Kington Langley.
Episode 11, Death and the Maiden.
Emily Tanner would like to tell you a story.
Old Lucy's mother was a beautiful woman, with dark eyes and raven curls. She was fond of gaiety and disliked housework. Her husband was very jealous of rivals, and they both drank heavily.
And so begins Emily Tanner's bedtime story. But as I explained, it's founded on truth, on real events that took place 13 years before Emily's birth. Old Lucy, her mother and her father were real people. And this is their real story. It's 1861. Kington Langley's St. Peter's Church is only 6 years old, its construction prompted by growing concern that the residents of Kington Langley lack clerical supervision and wholesome discipline. Too many villagers are being brought before the magistrates. Attendance at the former parish church in Kington St. Michael and its school have been poor. Back in the mid-1800s, Kington Langley was not winning any Best Behaved Village Awards. Which brings us to John and Fanny Pierce, a couple living in the small cottage on Jacksams Lane in 1861. They've been there for some years. John is a labourer born in Harden Hewish, Chippenham in 1816. He married Frances, or Fanny, in Chippenham when they were both 20. By 1861, they're sharing their small rented property with their son James and a lodger called Christopher Cole, Critty Cole to the people who know him well. They're both 45 years old. Their five older children have left home, including their daughter, Lucy. John's earning 30 shillings a week working for the Chippenham-based railway contractor, Roland Brotherhood. Brotherhood is the man who built the extensive engineering works in Chippenham including the foundry that once stood on Foundry Lane. Which brings us to the next part of Emily Tanner's story.
One Saturday, they walked together over the fields to Chippenham for a good booze up. On the way back home, something happened.
It's Saturday night. Saturday, the 13th of October, 1861. It's dark. The streets of Chippenham are quiet. Somewhere nearby, a dog barks, then is silent. Off in the trees, a screech owl calls. It's 9 p.m. A farm labourer called William Bristow from Langley Burrell is making his way home from Chippenham when he hears voices in the street. It's John and Fanny Pierce, intoxicated after an afternoon's drinking at the Black Horse in town, walking back to Kington Langley. Bristow knows them. John is about 10 yards ahead of Fanny. They're on Greenway Lane, the road running from St. Paul's Church out to the very edge of Chippenham. Today, the lane is flanked by housing estates all the way to Birdsmarsh Wood. But back then, Greenway Lane was a rural track, lined by trees and hedgerows, with only the light from an isolated farmhouse to interrupt the darkness. Bristow first catches sight of the Pierces opposite the Reverend Asher's new houses. That's the little street called the Hamlet, a row of attractive cottages in what is known as the Anne Hathaway style. In those days, it was a private road owned by the Ash family of the Langley Burrell estate. The Pierces' antics make quite an impression on Bristow. Fanny is calling out for her husband. "Oh, John! Don't, John!" When Bristow turns off the lane into a field, he hears the couple stumble and fall. Curious, Bristow peers through the hedge. He sees John and Fanny lying together on the ground, John poking his wife's legs with an umbrella. "John," she cries, "John!" "Come, get up," John says. "Let us go on." With some difficulty, John rises to his feet and begins to walk unsteadily in the direction of Kington Langley. Concerned that Fanny has been left alone, Bristow goes to her aid. Twice she tries to get up but can't. Bristow asks if he can help her. "Honour bright, William," she replies. With some difficulty, Bristow lifts Fanny to her feet. She staggers after her husband, who's now waiting for her 30 yards ahead. Reunited, they both slump against a wall. Bristow approaches, close enough to hear John say to his wife, "I will cut your head off." And again, "I will cut your head off." Bristow's shocked. "What do you mean by that?" he asks John. John's reply is nonsensical. "I'll fight any man that ever I see." "Go home, John," advises Bristow. John pulls a face. "Give me some beer and tobacco, and I'll go anywhere." Fanny tries to walk, but only succeeds in falling again. Bristow sets her upright once more, and the couple set off slowly and unsteadily up Greenway Lane towards the dark bulk of Birdsmarsh Wood and the open fields beyond. Their home on Jacksom's Lane lies over the brow of the hill. Fanny is in the lead, John follows, singing to himself. It's the last time that Bristow sees them that night.
They had a fierce quarrel at the end of Greenway Lane, both fighting drunk, till old Pierce knocked his wife down. She fell against a tree where he left her and staggered home to bed.
It's now 4:30 on Sunday morning, still dark. Farm labourer Henry Knight is up long before the dawn. He's got cows to milk, chores to attend to. Leaving his home in Langley Burrell, he follows muddy tracks across the fields until he reaches one in particular, Nine Pin Field. It lies somewhere between Birdsmarsh Wood and Jacksom's Lane. The records tell us very little. As he crosses the field, Knight spots a figure, a muddy and dishevelled John Pierce alone, walking towards his house. "Were you drunk last night, John?" Knight calls. "Could you not get home?" John Pierce looks at Bristow. No, he replies, and walks on. As John disappears into the darkness, Knight follows the slope of the field down towards the dairy farm where he works. Even though dawn is still over 2 hours away, Knight thinks he can make out a dark shape on the ground, where no shape should be. His nerves get the better of him. He's too afraid to approach, though. Instead, he leaves the field by a gate. He passes an umbrella, lying in the grass. Knight proceeds to the farm. Just after he's milked a second cow, another labourer, Henry Cousins, arrives. Knight tells him that he's seen something odd in Ninepin Field. The two of them pluck up the courage to return. They see a woman's bonnet on the step of a stile, crumpled and torn. Growing concerned, the labourers make for the spot where Knight earlier saw the dark shape on the ground. It's Fanny Pierce. She's lying on her right-hand side, clothes mud-stained and disarrayed. She's quiet, perhaps drunk, perhaps asleep. Confused and unsure of how to respond, the two farm labourers flee the scene.
He slept like a log till 4 in the morning when he awoke to find himself alone. Bewildered, he went to seek help.
It's now 5:30. 26-year-old Christopher Critty Cole, the Pierce's lodger, is awakened by the sound of someone entering the house. Moments later, his bedroom door opens. It's John Pierce, pale and unwashed, reeking of alcohol. "What's up?" mumbles Cole. The old woman is down in the Ninepin ground. But whether she has had a fit or no, I cannot tell. She is tearing her bonnet and clothes and beating herself all to pieces. Whether anyone has been giving her anything, I cannot tell. Cole rouses himself, dresses. The men leave the house for Ninepin Field. Fanny's still there, unresponsive. Cole sees that she has a blackened eye and bruises on both arms. Her clothes are filthy. The men lift Fanny's body from the damp grass. "Can you walk?" Cole asks her. "No," she manages to reply. So Cole and John Pierce carry Fanny across 2 fields until they find a wheelbarrow. Slowly, they let Fanny sink into the barrow, then wheel her home. The Pierce's neighbour, Elizabeth Scriven, sees the two men arrive with the insensible Fanny around 7 o'clock. Grunting with exertion, they carry her through the door and up the narrow flight of stairs to her bed. John Pierce asks Cole to fetch a doctor. Cole runs from the house, but already it's too late. According to Elizabeth Scriven, when she examines Fanny, she's dead. Scriven goes downstairs to find John sitting in a chair. "John," she says, "was Fanny like that when you found her?" "Yes," he replies. "She was the same when I came back to her as when I went away." "Then, John, you did it?" Elizabeth asks. "They will say that I murdered her," he says. Elizabeth replies, "They do say that already."
It was 5 o'clock when they saw her, still by the tree where she had fallen, deeply unconscious. They bundled her into a wheelbarrow and got her home, to die. The verdict was manslaughter, but for years, old Pierce was in jail where old Lucy used to visit him.
Constable James Matthews is the first police officer on the scene. He enters the bedroom, studies Fanny's body, then goes downstairs to where John awaits. "John Pierce, I'm charging you with causing the death of your wife, Frances Pierce." "Oh, very well," says John. And he tells the tale of their afternoon's drinking and the evening's walk home. "As we came to the field, I went on a short distance before her. Finding she did not come along, I returned and found she was very ill and could not stand. I remained with her to see if I could not get her round, till between 2 and 3 o'clock in the morning, when I went home for assistance." Later, Superintendent James Wright visits Ninepin Field to examine the spot where Fanny lay. The ground is well trodden. There are blood marks on blades of grass. Also a piece of fabric stained with blood. Fanny's body is examined by a doctor from Sutton Benger, George Stratton Simmons. He conducts a post-mortem with another doctor, William Whitmarsh. They too note bruising on Fanny's arms. But there's much more. Fanny's skull has sustained a contused wound at the rear of her head. Simmons thinks this wound is more in keeping with a fall than a blow. An artery has ruptured in Fanny's brain, leaving a large blood clot. Her liver is extensively ruptured, also possibly due to a fall. Both eyes are severely contused, probably the result of violence, the surgeons declare, a direct blow from a fist. Later, Simmons will say that Fanny's face was free from distortions, meaning she has not died from a convulsion. He believes the cause of death is the ruptured artery in Fanny's brain, but the cause of the blow that created the rupture is unclear. Whitmarsh thinks that cuts to Fanny's ears may have been caused by a booted foot. He also notes that her stomach contains a pint and a half of fluid, smelling strongly of gin. The following Monday, a coroner's inquest is held in Kington St. Michael before a jury. At this point in the Victorian age, coroner's juries are still common. The evidence is considered, and the jury's foreman stands to deliver the verdict. That the deceased came to her death from extreme violence. But by whom this violence was administered, there is no direct evidence to show. A week passes. A week during which news of the death of Fanny Pierce begins to spread widely. On Saturday, John is brought before the magistrate's court at Chippenham Town Hall. In the street outside the building, hundreds of people have gathered. The story of Fanny's death has made newspaper headlines right across Britain and Ireland, including the London Daily News. This is not the first time John has been in front of a court. In his late teens, he had been sentenced to 2 months in jail for what the Devizes and Wiltshire Gazette called breaches of the game law. Two magistrates preside, both well-known figures locally. Sir John Audrey, a barrister, and Lord Methuen, owner of Corsham Court and an aide to Queen Victoria. Even today, the Methuen name is still well-known in North Wiltshire. Dressed in a white shift and corduroy trousers, John enters the crowded room, head down. For 5 hours, the magistrates listen to testimonies from the same witnesses who gave evidence at the inquest a week earlier. Elizabeth Scriven, the Pierce's neighbour, gives more details this time. She describes seeing Fanny's body in bed covered in bruises and scrapes, also blows to her chest and head. When the hearing concludes, John Pierce is cautioned. All I have to say is that I never beat the woman, he declares. Lord Methuen leans down to confer with the magistrate's clerk. Minutes pass. The court is silent. Methuen sits upright to give his verdict. John Pierce is committed for trial at the next Wiltshire Assizes for manslaughter. The assizes are periodic courts, usually reserved for the most grievous offences. Judges tour the circuit, moving from court to court. Assizes will continue right up until 1972, when the law is changed. It's 6 months before John comes to trial, during which time he's held in jail. Finally, in March 1862, a date for his case to come before the assizes is fixed. Thursday, the 3rd of April. According to the press, with 45 prisoners listed, it's the longest cause list for 20 years. And so the day of John's trial arrives. At the imposing Assizes Court in Northgate Street, Devizes, members of the grand jury are sworn in. The court is built of Bath stone and designed in the classic Grecian style. Four columns support a triangular pediment. Steps lead up from the street to the entrance. It's like a Greek temple. The building is still there today, shuttered and fenced off. Two judges preside today, Mr. Justice Byles and Mr. Justice Blackburn. They've just arrived from Cornwall. When it's John's turn to stand in the dock, he's indicted for the felonious killing of Fanny. Not guilty, he pleads. His trial commences. However, at some point during the proceedings, the judge intervenes. He draws the jury's attention to the evidence of the surgeon doctors. It was their opinion, he says, that her injuries may have been caused by a fall. Indeed, the appearance of Fanny's body may have been produced by a fit causing the bursting of blood vessels. Under these circumstances, the judge concludes, John's case shall not be allowed to go to the jury. A man cannot be found guilty of manslaughter when the cause of death is in doubt. The judge directs the jury to return a verdict of not guilty. After 6 months in jail, John Pierce is a free man.
Later, old Lucy married Critty Cole, and they had several children with consumption of the bowels. The youngest was Tiddle Tiddle Fly in the Air.
Although there's no record of what happened when John Pierce was released from jail in 1862, by 1871, he's living in Kington Langley with his daughter Lucy and her husband, Christopher Critty Cole. By 1881, he's left to move in with his son's family in Chippenham, where he dies in 1900. He's buried in the London Road Cemetery. Frances Fanny Pierce is buried in the churchyard of St. Peter's, Kington Langley, on the 17th of October, 1861, 3 days after her death. Some years later, the village's wealthier residents make donations to pay for a memorial headstone. It's still there, marked as Grave 013 on the plan of the graveyard. It's a grand headstone, but sadly the face of the grave is so badly eroded, only a single word is visible. Pierce. Within a few years, that too will be gone, and all trace of Fanny will be lost. As for the Pierce's daughter, Lucy, she did marry Critty Cole, the lodger, who helped carry her mother's body across the field in a wheelbarrow. The story of John and Fanny Pierce is finished. There have been many deaths in Kington Langley over the centuries, but none that I can find have ever aroused such interest as Fanny's. What journalists call the lamentable case was reported far and wide across the British Isles. The Victorian public was outraged. Perhaps it was the lack of dignity afforded Fanny as her senseless body was dragged across Ninepin Field. Perhaps it reaffirmed middle-class readers' belief that no good could come from hard drinking and loitering in taverns. Did Fanny suffer from a fit? It's possible, but we have no knowledge of her medical history, only that she was strong enough to bear 5 children. Was John as innocent as he protested? Or did Fanny's blackened eyes hint at what really happened that night? We'll never know. John and Fanny's story may be finished, but Emily Tanner's is not. Emily's tale concludes with a coda, a strange footnote to Lucy and Critty Cole's marriage. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. I only hope not. I'll let Emily herself tell it to you.
One day, when Lucy was shaking the lunch crumbs from Critty's flaccid basket, a mouse ran up her arm. So when the baby was born, its mouth was arched like a mouse's, with 2 sets of teeth. She would sit in the corner mumbling, her fingers scrabbling over her face, like a mouse washing itself.
The information used in this episode was taken from the British newspaper archive, Ancestry.com, Sheila Calhoun's book, The Story of Kington Langley, and some other local history materials. I hope you've enjoyed the story, and Emily Tanner's, which was written down, I think, in 1989. This has been Memories of Kington Langley. Goodbye. Thank you.